Hello, and thank you so much for tuning into the Psychology Is podcast. I'm Nick Fortino, and I'm here today with Dr. Lasana Harris. Welcome, Lasana. How are you?
Thanks for having me. I'm doing well.
Dr. Harris is a professor and researcher at University College London and has written a book that I found to be quite compelling called Invisible Mind: Flexible Social Cognition and Dehumanization. And I just think this is a very timely, insightful, clear, logical book. In fact, my first question for you is this a version of your dissertation by any chance?
No, I think when I did my dissertation, I had no idea what I was doing. I think this book was an attempt to get my thoughts straight. So I actually view this book like a dissertation in a sense. And I wish my dissertation was this book sometimes. But this book was really a chance for me to collect my thoughts on the issue, because dehumanization spans so many disciplines that it really required taking the time to write them all out and try to find a coherent story throughout all of them. And it really served that purpose. So for me, the main motivation for writing this book was to clarify my thinking on the issue.
It reads like a dissertation. It's just extremely systematic in the way that you introduce the concepts, and you're very thorough about defining your terms, and it's full of citations. So yeah, just, you know, that was why I asked, and it makes sense that you kind of see it in that way. So let's dive right in to the material here. The first thing I want to ask you to define for us, and let me just back up a little bit and just say again to our listeners, I really appreciate you being here. And I just want to mention that we publish this podcast on pretty much all platforms, YouTube, where we also publish other types of videos, and all the audio, and the audio only on all the podcast streaming platforms. So just wanted to mention that, because I know that YouTube isn't the ideal platform for everyone to be listening to long form conversations. So if you want to use another one, you can find us there too. So anyway, back to the material. Will you start by explaining to us what is social cognition, and then what do you mean by flexible social cognition?
Sure. So social cognition are the set of skills that allow us to interact with other people. Specifically, they're the psychological skills that facilitate our ability to mind read or infer what other people are thinking. So if you and I, Nick, are having a conversation, I have to be able to get inside of your head so that I could infer your intentions, your goals, and properly interpret all of your verbal and nonverbal behaviors. And that's only possible if I'm engaging social cognition while we interact. And so in a sense, social cognition is the skill that makes humans special, unique and distinctive relative to other animals on this planet, because we believe that even though other animals have social cognitive abilities, human beings are the only animals that have the ability to flexibly engage social cognition. So if another animal encounters a conspecific, so another member of their species, they will spontaneously engage these inference processes or interactive processes to facilitate that interaction. But with human beings, we have the ability to encounter other human beings and fail to consider what's going on inside of their heads, fail to consider their minds. And that's what we mean by flexible social cognition. So the flexibility really refers to our ability as human beings to toggle on and off this process. It also captures the other side of the coin, which is what we call anthropomorphism. So our ability to see minds and human beings where there aren't any. So we talk to our pets as if they were people. We yell at our computers knowing they won't yell back, right? And so we don't just save our social cognition skills for other people, we use them for other types of objects, entities, and agents that aren't human beings. And that's another feature of the flexibility as well. Mm-hmm. So social cognition is the skills we have that facilitate social interactions. Flexibility simply means that it's not inevitable. Mm.
And like you wrote, we can withhold social cognition or we can stretch it, and which I understand is stretching it is that anthropomorphism, and then withholding it is dehumanization, right? So
exactly.
Okay. Now let me just ask you this question that is just coming to my mind in this moment. We engage in social cognition, and clearly we have a better chance of being accurate with our inferences about what's going on in someone else's mind when all channels of communication are available. So when we're actually in person with somebody. But then, of course, you can take away one channel of sort of data at a time by making it like right now, we can actually see each other and hear each other, but I can't see your body language below your shoulders. And so there's some data that I'm not taking in about your mental state. And then you can, of course, strip away more and more and more. You can take away the whole visual. You can take away, and it can just be a digital back and forth. It can just be texting. So, in you know, just talk to me about that. Like, how do you see social cognition when it scales down to singular channels of communication?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. If you think about how human beings evolved, we never had the opportunity to communicate digitally like we do now. So our brains evolved in a context where there was only face-to-face interactions. And so when people interact face-to-face, you get the auditory information. What does this person sound like? Visual information. What do they look like? All of the nonverbal behaviors. You get olfactory information as well, right? You can sort of get smells from the person that subtly influence how you think about them. And so there's a lot of streams of data coming in. That inference process, however, doesn't necessarily depend on any of those. So I could engage in social cognition with an imaginary other person. So right now I could imagine that there's someone standing next to me and I can have a conversation with that person without getting any data coming from that person because, of course, they don't really exist. And I think that's what's really fascinating about social cognition. Because it's an inference process, right? Because I'm not actually perceiving your mind, right? I'm not staring at it. I'm not getting visual information about your thoughts. I have to infer your thoughts based on these other bits of data. If you restrict the amount of data that's coming to me, I can still make a guess as to what's in your mind. So even with zero data at all, I can still engage social cognition, right? Like I said, I can talk to an imaginary person. And I find that really fascinating because it highlights that inference component, which means we're making this stuff up. So social cognition really is an imagination process. And because it's an imagination process, it doesn't depend on accuracy. So what matters when we interact isn't what you're actually thinking, but it's what I imagine that you're thinking, because that's what's going to guide the interaction. So if I imagine that you're a really nice person, even though you may be a horrible human being, I'm going to treat you as a really nice person. And that's going to govern the interaction. And I find that fascinating about social cognition.
And now I'm curious to know your view, your understanding of the accuracy of our social cognition and that the inferences we make and how much it matters to be accurate about social cognition.
Yeah, so because of the fact that this is an inference process, psychology as a field abandoned accuracy decades ago. So in psychology, we didn't really study accuracy because we understood that what was real didn't matter. What mattered was what I thought was real, how I constructed the social situation. Now, that's not how we think about other people's minds as we navigate our world, right? We think that if I decide that's a terrible person. We think we're pretty accurate, right? We don't question that judgment typically unless there's some information that runs counter to it. And even in those cases, we'll probably find a way of explaining away that counter information to preserve the idea or the inference that we initially had. So in some senses, psychology has abandoned accuracy because it's irrelevant for how we engage in the social interaction. And to some extent, that makes sense because if you think about any human being, we're complex creatures. And there are multiple possible versions of myself within me. And so for some people, I may behave in a particular manner. And then for other people, I may change my behavior and behave differently. Those two sets of people may have very different impressions of me. Now, which one of these is accurate? Well, they both are accurate and neither are really accurate. And so because of paradoxes like that, I think the field has abandoned accuracy. Recently, some researchers have started studying accuracy again, primarily in the context of empathic responding and empathic accuracy. So our ability to detect whether somebody is actually suffering and in need of help or support. And in the context of empathy, I think accuracy becomes more relevant because it has real implications for how we behave towards other people. If someone is suffering, this is not determined whether they need help or not. But for much of how we interact socially as human beings, accuracy is largely irrelevant, right? What's relevant is the ideas or the inferences that I make. And so myself included, we haven't really asked the accuracy question because we haven't seen it as fundamentally important to how these processes work. And ironically, that's what allows me to do things like dehumanize, right? So I can think someone is actually not a human being despite evidence to the contrary, right? Because again, accuracy, reality is irrelevant in that sense. Accuracy is irrelevant. And that's really important to note and remember. But we don't think of it that way in our typical interactions.
So this is interesting because my feeling is like, I guess I'll propose some examples where I think accuracy would be important. And one, I guess, would be if you mentioned this in your book, so I'll mention this example. You could have an authority figure, law enforcement, inferring that someone that they're attempting to detain is planning to retaliate violently, is planning to pull out a gun and shoot them, when that's definitely not what the person is thinking at all. But if that's the inference, that would dramatically affect the behavior of law enforcement in that moment and make them get excessively defensive. And so I could see, you know, and what would you say to an example like that, where such an inaccurate inference could actually lead to a tragic outcome?
I think that's typical of human behavior. Right? Because in that moment, that law enforcement official will say they know that person has a gun, right? Evidence to the contrary can be presented after the fact and you can discover, oh, the person really didn't have a gun. But because I perceive that person as a threat, what I know is that there are neurons in my visual cortex, my early visual cortex, that actually are changing the way they perceive the world. So if I think that person has a gun and they're holding a wallet, these early visual neurons, which are really low level based on perceiving very low level features, are going to be tuned in such a way that they end up seeing a gun where there isn't any. Mm-hmm. And so from that person's point of view, from that law enforcement person's point of view, there really is a gun there because their brains are telling them as much. Now, in reality, that's not the case. There is no gun. There is no threat. But the way we operate as human beings isn't by perceiving reality. It's by constructing it. And the constructions that our brains create become our reality. They become the accuracy. And so it begins to explain why, for instance, there are intractable conflicts around the world, because people on different sides of the conflict are literally seeing things differently. They're not just having different opinions. they're viewing exactly the same behavior in very different ways. And this ability to have the same visual input and see or perceive very different things is something we experience every day. So let me give you an example. Suppose you're at an airport and you see someone crying. If they're crying in the departures lounge, you may make the inference that they're feeling sad. Probably they've just left someone who they love. If you see exactly the same behavior, but now they're in a different context, they're now crying in the arrival lounge, you're going to make the inference that they're happy. Maybe they're welcoming someone they haven't seen in a long time. So exactly the same behavior, the data coming in is exactly the same, is leading you to different inferences about that person's mind. That's how human beings work. And that's what, to me, makes psychology really fascinating. Because in a sense, yes, reality goes out the window. And what really matters are the ideas we have about the world around us. And so in the case of the law enforcement, what we have to do then is not get into an argument about whether there really was a gun there or not, but deal with the fact that you found that particular person threatening, when perhaps there are other types of people that you don't view as threatening in the same scenario. Why is it then that you view that particular person as a threat? And what can be done to mitigate such unnecessary or unwarranted threat perceptions? Mm-hmm. So taking this accuracy question on board causes us to target our interventions, if you will, in a very different place, right, than it would be if we're just fighting about, well, is it really the case that there was a gun there or not? So our brains are remarkable in that way. And it's not something that we're aware of because we're engaged in our own realities. We're seeing the world the way that we see it.
Interesting. Very interesting. Yeah, it makes sense. And your example of the person in the airport being at the departure or the arrival section is a good example of something else you talk about, which is the power of the social context in influence in the way we make inferences. So that's interesting. And then, yeah, I mean, just reflecting here about just this fundamentally subjective nature of human perception. And it's interesting because it's like, me personally, I wouldn't want to throw reality completely out the window and objectivity completely out the window, because you can think of some extremely bizarre perceptions that people could have, which if they were to act as though they were true, the person would become very maladaptive. And so to me, there's some semblance of objective consensus reality that I think we have to preserve in understanding human social cognition. But let me ask you, do you think that we can become more accurate in our mind reading, in our inferences? And is it important to try to perceive things more accurately or clearly?
I think there's something you said there that's really important. And that's consensus. So you said objective consensus.
Right.
And I think that's how we establish reality as a species that's making it up as we go along. Mm-hmm. So if multiple people agree, now we have reality. So I prefer to view reality in that way. Reality results from consensus, right? So if I see something and I think it's dangerous and everybody else agrees, then that thing becomes dangerous. But because our individual minds can't be trusted, let's say, we have to rely on consensus to get to accuracy. Mm-hmm. So it takes you to a philosophical question about whether there's a capital T truth, right? Whether there's an objective reality out there in the first place, or is it simply something that's constructed? And I lean more on the constructed side of that argument. And I think where capital T truth comes in is through the consensus. Now, to address whether it's important that we establish accuracy, I would say it's important that our inferences are consistent with our goals. So that's a very long-winded way of answering that question. So let's take the empathy situation. Let's say there's some homeless person sitting at the side of the street. And as I pass by that person, I decide to get inside of their head and make the determination that they're suffering. Now, the accuracy argument says the person might be actually suffering, and it's important that we recognize human suffering where it occurs so that we can attempt to mitigate it. But that's only true if mitigating human suffering is consistent with my goals. If it's inconsistent with my goals, then perhaps it makes sense or it's better for me to dehumanize that person, ignore their suffering, treat them as an object in the street rather than a human being who's suffering, and go about my business. And so the need for accuracy only appears in situations where accuracy helps us attain our goals. So if my goal is to remove a tumor and I'm a surgeon, accuracy is fundamental. I don't want to look at an organ and think it's a tumor. But if there's another scenario where accuracy isn't necessarily relevant to my goal, then I think accuracy isn't as relevant. Again, this isn't how we experience the world as human beings. We think everything we see is accurate, right? We think black is black and white is white. But psychologically, that's how our brains work. And in some sense, we derive confidence in our perception of reality when we achieve objective consensus. So when everybody says the George Floyd murder was a horrible thing, now we can go along with that perception as accurate. But if everyone ignores it, as they did with the Tulsa massacre 100 years ago, it becomes less important. So the consensus is really vital in determining accuracy and reality, I think.
Strong argument. Makes sense. Yeah. And yeah, I like the example of the importance of being accurate when you're a surgeon removing a tumor and not just saying, in my perception, this, what you all see as a heart, is just a tumor. It's a good example. But then, okay, so I want to dive into what you said about walking past a homeless person on the street and dehumanizing them. So you have talked in your book about the evolutionary basis for flexible social cognition, that engaging in social cognition has costs and benefits. And so I wanted to hear you elaborate a little bit more, because I didn't quite catch it in the book. What are the costs of social cognition? Is it an effort thing, or what is it? And then I'll go to my next question after that. I won't forget it, but talk to me about that. What are the costs of social cognition?
So if you look in the brain at the regions that support social cognition, it's primarily a distributed network in the neocortex, the neocortex being the more recently evolved part of the brain. So that's the part of the brain that supports things like logical reasoning and your ability to do arithmetic, for instance. And it turns out that it's a big distributed network. So it takes up a lot of cognitive processing to figure out what somebody's thinking. And that makes sense, because the way we figure out what somebody's thinking is through this statistical integration process. So we get information about the context and information about our learning history. What do we know happens in this situation? Information about past interactions with this person, information about what people typically do in this situation, right? And there's a lot of numbers that we essentially crunch to come up with the inference that person is suffering, that person is happy, that person just wants a cup of tea. So it doesn't feel like it's a complex process to us, because we're experts at it, we're human beings, and we're constantly doing this, but it does take up a lot of cognitive resources. Those cognitive resources can sometimes be used for other things. So let's go back to the surgeon example. We've done research, and other labs have as well, that demonstrate that if someone is very empathic, so I'm worrying a lot about some other person's suffering, that's taking away cognitive resources I could instead be using to perform the surgery. So in the operating theater, if I'm worried about how much this person is suffering and how worried their family are, that's a distraction from my very careful work that I need all of my cognitive resources for. So in that sense, it's better to regulate social cognition, dehumanize the person, treat them as a broken machine and shut out their mind, do the surgery, and then switch it on again later on to figure out how are they going post-treatment, are they recovering okay? So the flexibility has benefits. The other thing is that if I've gotten inside of your head and it's a dark place, that may cause me personal distress. And what we know is that human beings make predictions about the outcomes of social interactions. So going back to the homeless people, I live in a big metropolitan city. There are dozens of homeless people I encounter every day. If I stop to feel the stress for each one of those people, it would be a very long day. And so if I need to regulate the amount of personal distress I feel, then it's better to shut out their minds. If I think about all of the thousands of people that are being killed by this horrible virus, that's a lot of suffering to think about. That's not necessarily how I might want to spend my emotional resources. And so there are clear costs to engaging social cognition, both in terms of the stress that it can cause and in terms of the cognitive resources that it takes. And so evolutionarily, it makes sense to have the ability to regulate it, right? I shouldn't want to have to respond in the same way every time I encounter a human being, because there are times where that response is maladaptive. Now, there are also cases where people can regulate social cognition to achieve things that we say are behaviors you won't typically engage another human being with. So if I'm treating someone in a very instrumental manner, for instance, let's say I'm a boss and I need to squeeze a little bit more profit out of my company, and I can do so by getting my employees to work a little bit harder for a little bit longer. Not thinking about the suffering I'm bringing on my employees is going to actually facilitate me achieving that goal of raising my profit margin. So again, it really depends on the context we're in, the goals we have, the situations that present themselves, whether social cognition is beneficial or it isn't. So the argument we make is that evolutionarily, it makes sense to have this flexibility with it because it can bring you benefits at times.
Makes perfect sense. And just to maybe clarify a little bit too for listeners, you've distinguished social cognition from empathy, but as I understand it, you consider social cognition to be a precursor to empathy.
So, exactly.
Right. Okay. So yeah, the cognitive resources involved in social cognition and the emotional resources involved in empathy are, you know, is just too much. It's just too much of a tax on them if we were to constantly be in this mode of socially cognizing when in every person we see. Makes sense. And that, so I understand you're saying that is kind of why the flexible nature of it evolved. And so one thing that is striking me as we're talking is I'm getting this sense that dehumanization, as kind of bad as that sounds, is not always like immoral. It's somewhat morally neutral. It's even useful to be able to dehumanize. But I imagine that you also recognize that we can do that too much to the point where we're now exploiting people or harming people because we have failed to humanize them. So talk to me about that. Like, where is it okay to dehumanize, and when is it a problem that we do this?
Yeah, the term dehumanization itself is problematic. So I've often said as psychologists, we should do what the economists do and use fancy Greek symbols to refer to the concepts instead of the lay language, because there's a lay understanding of dehumanization and it's associated with human atrocities. And so we hear dehumanization and we think terrible things. And there actually is research in psychology on what is called blatant dehumanization, which is your traditional definition of dehumanization. So it's essentially name calling. So I refer to somebody as vermin or rats or dogs or some less than human object or species, and that's dehumanizing, and that's present in propaganda speeches, for instance, during human atrocities. And so even in the legal community, the International Commission for Human Rights views dehumanization as a causal mechanism for human atrocities. So if someone is on trial for war crimes or genocide, right, they're pulling all of their propaganda speeches, they're pulling out the dehumanizing language, and they're saying, look, you've added fuel to the fire, right? You've dehumanized this group, which has caused this genocide to happen. That's where we step in as scientists and say, hang on a minute, we don't think that's quite how it works. So if you stick to this genocide case, what we think is happening is that dehumanization is one of many mechanisms that these dictators or political figures or military leaders are using, right? So if you look at propaganda speech, it's not just dehumanization that's in there. So some sociologists have done some wonderful research looking at the different themes in propaganda. And dehumanization is present, but it's maybe seventh or eighth on the list in terms of frequency. People are much more interested in talking about threats. And so we think what might be doing more of the causal work isn't this cognitive dehumanization mechanism. It's the fact that you identify those people over there as a threat to your very existence, to your way of life, to your culture. And threat is a much better motivator for violence than something cognitive like dehumanization, right? Threat taps into your survival mechanism. Dehumanization is present, we think, because it serves a justificatory purpose. So once the violence has begun, and I am no longer in this state of threat, I've already killed my neighbor, I might reflect on that behavior and be overwhelmed with moral guilt. Dehumanization is now hard because if I don't think about the suffering of my neighbor, or I think they weren't quite human like me, so they didn't really suffer, then I don't feel the same level of moral guilt that I might feel if I consider them a full human being. So we think dehumanization may not be causal in getting things like the violence started, but it might play a role in keeping it going, right? Because it justifies it. And there's evidence, for instance, in psychology studies where researchers Roger Genesarola and Emanuele Castano did a really interesting study where they had Americans reflect on the death of Native Americans once Europeans came. And they either blamed the death on the violence of the Europeans or on pathogens that the Europeans brought. And in the violent condition, participants dehumanized Native Americans more as a justificatory mechanism, right? To sort of not feel as guilty that our ancestors led to the devastation of these people. Whereas in the pathogen case, well, it wasn't really our fault, right? We didn't commit the harm, so there's no need to dehumanize. So that's how I think dehumanization operates. I also think dehumanization plays a role in the actual committing of the violence itself. So I often say, I don't think dehumanization gets you to pick up the machete to go attack your neighbor. But when you're at the front door, dehumanization helps, right? If I need to now hack you to bits, because again, hacking a live human to bits isn't necessarily something that I might want to do. However, there's other evidence that runs slightly counter to that, which is also worth considering. So researchers Tage Ray and Alan Fisk did a study where they demonstrated that if I intentionally wish to harm someone, I don't want to dehumanize them. I want to know that I'm making that person suffer. So the actual violence doesn't rely on dehumanization. Dehumanization is counterintuitive. If I'm instrumentally harming someone, however, now dehumanization is useful. So if I'm buying cheap clothing made by sweatshop workers, I don't want to think about the sweatshop workers, right? Because that might make me feel bad about this cheap clothing I'm buying. And so I'm more likely to dehumanize. So once you start looking at dehumanization scientifically, it's much more than a simple connection between dehumanization and human atrocities, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not this one-to-one, completely negative connection. It's playing a more nuanced role in those cases. And it's also something that's occurring in our everyday lives, right? As we talked about previously. So dehumanization is a loaded term in that sense. And recently I've started saying flexible social cognition a lot. So I don't get into fights with people about dehumanization because we have such a strong prior about what dehumanization is that the kinds of mechanisms we're describing, do we still believe that dehumanization, don't operate at that full psychological level. And so it's a bit of the traditional view of dehumanization, but not quite. It's much more nuanced than that.
And you just articulated that nuance very clearly. So that was helpful to kind of think through this with you, because yeah, it brought all kinds of thoughts to mind. And it was interesting your comment about if someone wants to harm, you know, you take a person who's deranged serial killer type of person, they don't dehumanize by any means. And I imagine that they might even anthropomorphize objects to then torture and kind of get satisfaction and torture a doll and imagine that it has a mind and then it's actually suffering. So it's like the opposite end of the spectrum. It's like this hyperhumanization, because that's the thrill of it, I suppose, for certain people. But then, yeah, on the other hand, you know, I understand you saying that essentially when we are committing atrocities, dehumanization is necessary, but definitely not sufficient. And perhaps we could just coin the term enemization, when you make enemies out of people and instill fear into the public, which is done in propaganda, and make people believe that this is an enemy who wants to threaten everything you love, then you can really get something that's far more hateful than dehumanization. And so, yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I've also heard you talk a lot about the confusion that certain terms can bring about, you know, especially when we are not unifying our language across disciplines. So perhaps this is one of those examples. Because when you walk by a homeless person and you essentially dehumanize them, it's kind of, to me, I almost think of it now as like a suspension of social cognition. You're withholding it. You're not assuming necessarily that this person, you know, is subhuman, but that you just kind of can't go there right now. You can't start inferring their mental states because it's just too resource costly for you as you go about your day.
Exactly. And so the first empirical research in psychology looking at dehumanization, they used the term infrahumanization for this reason. And so what they were studying, these were Belgian researchers at the turn of the century. What they were studying was how willing people were to attribute complex emotions to outgroups. So complex emotions are emotions where you have to get inside the person's head if you're using it. So if I say you feel regret, that's very different from saying you feel sad. So a dog can feel sad, but will an animal, a non-human, feel regret? Probably not as much, right? Because they don't have the same mental capacity. And what they discovered is that people were less willing to attribute these more complex emotions. And so they called it infrahumanization for exactly this reason, right? Dehumanization was just such a loaded term, they couldn't use it. So they used something else instead. What that ends up doing, I think, is bringing up a jargon problem to psychology, where we have all of these terms that people aren't using in the same way. So take empathy, for instance. My view of empathy is that it's an emotional response that's downstream from social cognition. So I first get in your head, know that you're suffering, I resonate with that suffering, and that to me is what empathy is, and that motivates me to help you. But there are other empathy researchers who say, well, there's cognitive empathy and affective empathy, and they call the social cognition cognitive empathy. And so we have real inconsistency with our use of jargon in the field, which is, again, another reason I think we should have done what the economists did and just use symbols. Because we can't agree on exactly what this is. If you take bigger concepts like emotion, nobody used to agree on what emotion was, right? And so psychology becomes difficult because we're trying to explain everyday human phenomena using the language of everyday humans. And that just gets us into trouble. So I often tell people psychology is perhaps the hardest scientific discipline for a variety of reasons, this being one of them. it's kind of like looking at your face with a piece of a mirror, right? How can I look at myself when I can't see the entire thing? And the other thing that makes psychology really interesting and difficult is that the minute your participants are aware that they're in a psychology study, their behavior is going to change. So chemicals in a jar don't change their behavior because I'm looking at them, but human beings do. So it's really hard to study these things. And then once you consider the ethics around studying something like dehumanization, right? We could never do a study where people are actually engaging in human atrocities, not even mild violence, right? It's unethical. And so we end up studying it in these ways where it seems far removed from the actual real-world behavior we're trying to explain. So psychology is a very challenging scientific discipline for these reasons. But I feel like in the last 20, 25 years, we've made real progress studying concepts like dehumanization by taking these approaches.
Yes, indeed. The subject matter of psychology does not behave all that consistently and doesn't translate well to the lab. But it's true that, I mean, my impression is the same, is that we're coming along and that things are evolving and our terms are becoming more specific. Interesting distinction there between infrahumanization and dehumanization. And I know you were partly using that as an example of the confused jargon, but it also sounds like there is perhaps a real distinction between them, just in that you're not quite dehumanizing them, but you're almost simplifying them to being less complex. That's interesting.
And you can complicate that further, right? So we also have objectification. Which we only use in the context of sexual objectification. So looking at treating people as bodies and sexual objects, that's also a kind of dehumanization, but it's yet another term, right? So just in the dehumanization literature, we have like four or five different approaches to what I think of as fundamentally the same phenomenon. Right. But it's difficult because of the terminology. You're exactly right.
Very interesting. So a lot of times when people talk about this, they use examples of, you know, for example, the Stanford prison experiment or social contexts where there are factors in the social context that pressure you to perceive people in a dehumanized way, be it the stripes that inmates have to wear or anything like that, right? And so and then sometimes that leads to indifference about the person, but then sometimes that seems to lead to mean treatment of the person. So I'm curious, in situations like that, where we can recognize that there's a social context here that is facilitating dehumanization, but I don't want to succumb to that. You know, for example, I think of it as myself. I work in a jail. And so it's extremely important for me that I do not let that social context shape my perception in this way. So can you just talk to me about this, when we actually don't want to be dehumanizing, when we would rather be extending our social cognition?
I think that's a really excellent point. And recently we've done research looking at that individual difference, right? So like everything else in this world, there's some variability there. And some people have more of a propensity to dehumanize than others. So this isn't about ability. This is about propensity. So how likely am I to flexibly engage social cognition? And we've been able to capture that recently with a measure. And there's some wonderful sort of historical anecdotes that really illustrate people resisting the contextual influence. So let's take people on death squads in Nazi Germany. There's wonderful research by a historian called Browning, who talks about people who were in the death squads who didn't want to be there, right? They had no choice but to join up and participate. And they would intentionally miss their shots and things like firing lines, right? Because they couldn't bring themselves to kill who they thought were innocent people. Now, they weren't in a position to voice that opposition, or else their own lives would be threatened. So they had to go along. But even in such a powerful context, right, they preserved their humanity, as he called it, and they engaged in behaviors where they could mitigate the possible impact of dehumanization. And I think that's true of all human beings. Some of us are more likely to be influenced by these situational factors, and some of us aren't. So you go back to the Milgram experiment, the Stanford Prison experiment, the bystander experiments. There's variability in that data set, right? There are some people who don't do it. Most of the people do, but there's variability. And because we're experimentalists, we're all about minimalizing variability because we want to be able to make an argument about what happens on average. But that variability shouldn't be ignored. Now, what allows somebody to be more able to resist than others, that's kind of the topic of this recent book we're doing, looking at this as an individual difference. So far, we've discovered a couple of things that matter. So one of the things we think matters is how you view yourself, and it runs sort of contrary to how you might think. So if I think of myself as a very moral person, I'm much more likely to dehumanize. Mm. If I recognize in myself that I can occasionally do bad things and be immoral, I'm less likely to fall victim of this social context and dehumanize. And there's actually a study that really nicely illustrates this in the context of police violence. So there's a researcher, Philip Goff. He did some studies with police officers where they simulated police training. And so what happens in this experiment is the police officer is in full tactical gear and they've been called out to a citizen encounter. So they've received the report of a disturbance. And then they encounter either an African-American person or a European-American person behaving belligerently towards them, waving a stick. And what they're measuring in this study is the police officers who choose to use lethal force. And what they discover is that police officers who are more explicitly biased, so who will tell you, I don't like Black people, were the ones less likely to use lethal force. Why is that? Well, in that context, if you live in America, you're aware of racial biases and stereotypes surrounding African Americans, and those stereotypes say that they're dangerous and threatening. So when you see an African American being belligerent, you get a threat response. But if I tell myself, I'm not racist, I'm egalitarian, I have Black friends, that threat response, which is the result of bias, gets read as an actual threat from that person. So you think that person's a literal threat. You don't realize it's just your biases because you think you don't have them. Whereas the officers who are explicitly racist, they know their bias. They're getting the threat response, but they know exactly what it is, right? This is how I always feel when I'm around these people. And so they are less likely to be influenced by that context. So that's a really counterintuitive way of thinking about this propensity to dehumanize. And we have evidence of that in our research as well. So the people who endorse statements like I'm very morally good are the ones who are the biggest dehumanizers in our studies, right? Because they probably think this is not something I'm capable of. So they're not monitoring the impact of the context on their behavior to the same extent.
Interesting.
Hence the reality conversation we were having, right? Brings it full circle.
So what is the solution to that?
That's the $100 million question. I don't think we have a solution as yet. So we know how to switch dehumanization on and off quite easily. I can do it in the lab quite easily. What we don't know is how to change the spontaneous response people have out in the real world. My personal belief is that the answer to that question isn't a psychology answer. So if the social context has so much importance, we have to change the social context. And that becomes a policy issue. So we need to engineer policy such that it creates situations where dehumanization is less likely. We also need to change cultural narratives that reinforce stereotypes about particular groups that are dehumanized. so that our spontaneous responses to those groups aren't dehumanizing responses. So again, that's not within the remit of psychology, and it's the reason why I do a lot of research with policymakers and NGOs, because I think that's where the real work has to happen. What we do know in psychology is the mechanisms. How do these things function? And it's really shined a light in the social context. So if we know that's the problem, we know cultural narratives are the problem, we need to begin changing those. So I believe policymakers are really where the power lies to begin solving these problems, as it is for many of the problems that we encounter as a species.
So what do you think are the factors of a social context that would minimize dehumanization?
So it's any social context that foreshadows somebody's experience, I think, is going to be valuable. So if the context can give me insight into your mind without me having to go look for it, I think it makes dehumanization less likely.
Okay.
So let's go back to the medical context. So we did some studies, and other researchers, one in particular, Jean Desetti, did some research as well, where we manipulated the context in which surgeons or medical professionals were engaging in rudimentary medical tasks. And what we find is they do a better job of those tasks in this sterile context. So if in our studies we had medical students stitching fake rubber arms, and they did a better job of stitching up those arms in a sterile medical-like environment than in a more social environment like a lounge where there were comfortable couches and lava lamps, etc. In Jean Desetti's studies, they had these professionals imagine doing the procedure at home versus doing it in the hospital. And they're, again, better at the hospital. And so that's a very specific contextual manipulation where the sterility of the context is driving dehumanization. But as you go from domain to domain, I don't think it's going to always be the same thing. And one of the things we haven't done is really, and I mentioned this at the end of the book as well, is we don't have a good understanding of what we mean by social context because it's everything. And so we don't have a way of properly categorizing or defining social context beyond it's everything that's not the individual themselves. And so we have to do a better job of sketching out what the social contexts are, the range of them. And recently, there's been some research in that direction. So there are researchers like Catherine Greenaway in Australia who's done some good work trying to define different types of social contexts, intrapersonal versus interpersonal. But that still doesn't get you all of the different physical environments that you might be in, which we also know are impactful. So there's a lot of work to still be done there before we can answer that question.
Mm. Okay. Gosh, it's extra interesting. one of the other questions I wanted to raise is, you mentioned stereotypes a few minutes ago, and you know, we understand in psychology that our perception is highly influenced by a bunch of psychological factors that some people call the perceptual set, which acts kind of as a filter through which we perceive the world. And when you getting to know yourself, I would claim that getting to know yourself should involve getting to know what factors prime your perception. And when it comes to social perception and cognition, the factors that prime our perception are essentially pre-existing beliefs or preconceived notions, or not necessarily preconceived, but notions that are based on whatever our exposure has been to certain groups of people. And so we are clearly primed to perceive certain people in certain ways and make very quick conclusions about their mental state, their intentions, what they're capable of, etc. So sometimes, of course, stereotypes might even have some basis in a statistical trend for a certain group, right? So some are not crazy, but some stereotypes are just pretty much crazy because they have no basis in statistics and they're far too broad sweeping, you know, to say anything, for example, about Asians is just pretty ridiculous given that Asia is an entire continent And so there's almost going to be nothing true about all Asians that wouldn't be true of all people. So just, I know you know this, but I'm just kind of expressing this for people listening, just thinking through what a stereotype is and perhaps the range of how well based a stereotype might be in reality. But I want to hear your thoughts on the way stereotypes shape social cognition and how we can kind of gauge whether a certain stereotype has any basis. And I'll just say one more thing. I know I'm talking a lot, but whether you think that there's any utility in stereotypes, in that it helps us make much faster inferences and therefore is less costly to our resources. So that's, you know, give you a few points of reflection there.
Yeah, there's a lot to say. There's a lot to say there. So let's have a go at it. Stereotypes are social learning. So you can only be aware of stereotypes if you're aware of the narratives within a particular culture. And these narratives are informed by history. So the truth of stereotypes comes from the history of that particular place. So stereotypes are informed by what happened historically, not by anything that's relevant today. And it's really important to point that out. So there are stereotypes about women being caregivers, and that's because women weren't allowed to work historically. And so the roles they had to assume were caring roles. Hence the association, because that's all stereotypes are, they're associations. Mm-hmm. Now, the classic argument in the field has been that stereotypes serve as heuristics, so they're mental shortcuts and they require less cognitive processing. And we know that's not true. Stereotypes rely on the same brain regions that inferences about traits rely on. Mm. They're no different. What stereotypes are, however, are overlearned associations. So they are more readily available, but they're not any less cognitively complex.
Interesting.
The way the human brain works is it's helpful to think of it as a predictive machine. So we're constantly generating predictions, and stereotypes have their utility in informing those predictions. So if I'm in a particular cultural context and there's someone approaching me, a stereotype becomes useful because it gives me a prediction about that person. Now, is it the only possible source of information? Absolutely not. But because it's overlearned, it ends up being the habitual thing that we do. So it gets to the point where in an American context, you can't help but see race. In other contexts, race is irrelevant. No one will recognize race, but something else might be relevant based on that historical context. So the notion of stereotypes being inevitable is a bit misguided because it suggests there's nothing we can do but be stereotypical, and that's not true. Now, is it easy to do? Absolutely not, because again, these are overlearned associations. But what we can do is think about other things when we encounter that person. And what we've been arguing recently is, again, related to this flexibility idea. When I encounter another human being, there are tons of possible inferences I can make. So there's a big literature in social psychology looking at something called spontaneous trait inferences, which simply says, if I see somebody engage in a behavior, I spontaneously infer a trait. So it's related to the idea of the fundamental attribution error. So if I suddenly get up and throw a chair across the room, you may think I'm a little bit crazy, right? Just from that one behavior. That trait inference happens after about 150 milliseconds. It doesn't take a really long time. So it's just as effective as a stereotype is for making a prediction about that person's next behavior. But we're not in the habit of doing that, right? As we navigate our world, because our cultural narratives are such that these categories have such importance in our society, we can't help but go to the stereotypes. So it's not the case that stereotypes are more efficient, they're just overlaid. So they're not buying us anything cognitively. And it's also not the case that stereotypes hold a kernel of truth. What they are the results of historical circumstances. And we know this lots of part because stereotypes shift. So there's a series of psychology studies called the Princeton Trilogy. There are actually now four studies, where since the end of World War II, they've been tracking stereotypes in the US. And they do a survey every 30 to 40 years, different researchers do it. The original researchers were Katz and Braley. The most recent work was done by Susan Fiss and Hilary Bergseeker. And what they show is how the stereotypes shift. So just after World War II, Japanese were a hated outgroup because of the Hiroshima situation and Pearl Harbor and their involvement in World War II. But by the 1980s, Japanese were business people bringing technology to American shores, right? You think about Nintendo and all of your favorite electronics products. And so the view of Japanese people shifted from being these dangerous enemies to potential business partners. So stereotypes naturally shift. And if there was a kernel of truth, that would suggest that the truth has shifted about these people. People haven't really stopped being who they are, but the historical circumstances have changed. And so now an American doesn't necessarily think of a Japanese person the way someone did right after Pearl Harbor. But they're probably not thinking about them the same way as in the 1980s either, right? Perhaps because of the coronavirus and all the rhetoric around that. So these things are moving targets. So they're constantly shifting to reflect the historical circumstances that gave rise to the situations we're now living in. So that's a helpful way of thinking about stereotypes. Again, that's a bit of a departure from the literature. These are my own sort of theories and ideas. There is support in the literature and we're actively doing research in this area. But I truly believe that's how these things operate psychologically based on the data we have and the brain data in particular.
Compelling arguments, really. I didn't know that stereotypes essentially activate the same area of the brain as more of a conscious social cognition processing. And that term that you're using, overlearned association, is a very good one. As you said, stereotypes are readily available. They're the first thing that comes to mind typically because they're habitual. They're so overlearned. Do you think that it's kind of inherently degrading to stereotype somebody?
I think in some senses it is, because it limits how you view that person. So if you're worried about accuracy, no, you're not going to get accuracy.
Right.
Even if the stereotype about the group was an average accurate, there's variability around that mean. So relying on the mean would still lead to inaccuracy. So if you're trying to be accurate, stereotyping isn't the way to go. And it is dehumanizing as well, because now I'm relying on an idea about you that isn't based on any information about you besides one thing. And we're complex creatures. There's so many things that are going on with us that relying on one thing is selling ourselves short and selling that person short as well. So I do think of stereotyping in that manner as well. It's not technically dehumanization, right? Because they actually engage the brain regions that get disengaged when you're dehumanizing. So it's not my definition, but it's dehumanizing in the lay way of using the term, the folk psychology way. The overlearned association is the important part, but they're not the only thing that's there. And that's really important to remember. So we used to talk about stereotypes as if they were inevitable and you had to get beyond the stereotype to get to something else, like a real trait inference about who the person is. That's not true. The trait is there as well. It's just, you're just not used to going for it. But we think that it's active as well when you, in fact, there are lots of things that are active. And again, that's a feature of human social cognition. It's a big expanded neocortical network because it's making many predictions available, not just the one. We're used to going with just the one, and so we stereotype. But we don't have to.
So I know I just want to acknowledge that we've been going for an hour and 10 minutes or so, and I told you we'd go for an hour. So if you need to end, you can let me know. And I also always want to acknowledge the listeners who are still with us and, you know, digesting everything we're talking about and thinking along with us. So I appreciate the presence of everyone listening and watching still. I have, I guess, just one more question, which is related to what you just described, what you just mentioned, the fundamental attribution error. And I'll tell you what my understanding of it is, and then we can see if yours, you know, aligns, or if you need to correct me on anything. So the fundamental attribution error is essentially when you misattribute someone's behavior to a cause. So you basically infer that the reason you just threw a chair across the room is because you're crazy, you're bizarre, you're an idiot, you're psychotic, when it might actually be due to something that is much more situational and impersonal, not a trait really, but a state dependent on the circumstances. So that's my sense of a fundamental attribution error. Does yours align with that?
That's exactly right. It's ignoring the situation, ignoring the social context. Mm. And that's what we do as human beings, right? Because other human beings are agents. They're things in the world that originate their own behavior. So if I see an agent in the world acting, I want the agent to be the cause of their behavior, right? Because now I can better explain it. But I might have thrown the chair because maybe there was a bomb under the chair and I'm just getting rid of it, right? So as human beings, we discount the power of the situation when looking at other people's behavior. But there's an argument, they call it the actor-observer effect again, or problem with jargon in psychology, where we don't discount that behavior for ourselves. So if I did badly in an exam, I don't think it's because I'm not bright, right? I think that exam is hard. I go to the situational explanation. But when I see you do badly in an exam, I think you're unintelligent. And so again, the human mind is a wonderfully flexible and complex machine, biological machine that's capable of lots of hypocrisy and many extremes, let's put it that way.
Yes, yes. And you know, there's layers to this as I think about it, because I can make a trait inference. I can attribute your behavior to a disposition, to who you are. And yet, then there's the question of, what do I think about why you are the way you are? And that, because it's like, in order to accurately infer that someone acted the way they did because it's their trait, you really need to observe them over time. You need to see what their consistent patterns are. So there's no way you can accurately determine whether it was a trait or a situational factor if it's just one instance of seeing them. But if you indeed do watch them over time and you conclude based on a lot of data, this is just how this person is. It's a trait that they act like this. But then again, that other layer is the question of how did they become like this? Because I can see that a person is abusive, for example, but then realize that they had an abusive childhood and those situational factors shaped them to become like this. So even though they are the agent responsible for that action, in a sense, they're not responsible for becoming that type of agent who would do something like that.
But you're exactly right. But everything has a situational explanation.
Right.
And a biological explanation. So we're all the way we are because of our biology and the situation we're in. But if I make the situational explanation salient, you're going to hold them less responsible. Right. It's because of their childhood. But we don't do that for everybody in every situation, right? And so the reason some boss, let's say, is terrible to their employees might be because of their childhood. Right? They were treated terribly by their parents. Nobody goes to that explanation, right? They say, you're just a horrible boss. And so we pick and choose when we allow the situation to be a mitigating factor. We don't do it universally. And that has ramifications for the legal context and how we assign guilt and innocence. And we've done a lot of work in that domain. It's a very fascinating set of principles, because it's all based on biology interacting with context. That's everything that we see. But this idea of an agent with a mind who's responsible is really important to us as a species. And so we make these inferences and hold people accountable. It's who we are.
And do you think this is a, diving into the philosophical deep end at the very end of our conversation, but it's of course related to the big question of freedom and determinism, or volition and determinism. So what is your stance philosophically on free will?
Yeah, so every scientist ends up being very deterministic as a result, except if you're a physicist. Physicists study string theory and chaos theory, and they think it's all random, and therefore there has to be some kind of free will. So I've done some writing in free will and determinism in the past, and from a scientific point of view, a psychological point of view, it's an illusion. It doesn't really exist. But we can't live our lives that way. Psychologically, we need to believe in this concept. We need to believe in freedom and choice. And we need to make attributions to people for their behaviors, or else our psychology won't work. And again, I think that's a human quality. I don't think that's something shared with other species. So philosophically, we're just beginning to dive into that, I think, even though we've theorized about it for millennia. We have the neuroscience now that we didn't have before to begin constraining some of these arguments. And we're just at the early stages of figuring that stuff out.
Yeah, it is truly fascinating. And I just, one comment on it. When I think through this philosophical mystery, I do see it as binary in a sense, because like some people take on the position, as you probably know, known as compatibilism, which is to say that free will and determinism are actually compatible. In my perhaps unpopular opinion, though, this, not every conflict, not every contradiction is a paradox we need to accept. Some things are just contradictions. And in my unpopular opinion, I think this is just a contradiction, actually, and that they can't coexist. And that if there's any room, if you assert freedom, there, or let's just say, if you embrace indeterminism, then you leave room for freedom. But then when you assert that there is free will, then I recognize a big continuum of the degrees to which people are free. And I think that some people have much stronger forces shaping their behavior than others do. Others are free to be much more intentional with their behavior because they don't have the same situational forces bearing down on them. So again, this is just like diving into the deep end here toward the end of our conversation, I know, but I just wanted to share that thought here as we're thinking through this together.
Yeah, who knows? I've had tons of philosophical arguments about this stuff, but it's fun to talk about. We don't have an answer. And it's okay that we don't have an answer.
Exactly, right? And the relevance to everything that we've been talking about, the relevance of this philosophical problem to the topic of social cognition is, if you embrace determinism, then you really don't have a real basis for making trait inferences or holding an agent responsible for their actions. You're always going to be oriented toward identifying situational factors that account for that person's behavior.
Or biological factors.
Mm-hmm. Right. Or biological factors, right. But impersonal, in a sense.
Yeah, not their minds.
Not their minds.
Absolutely right. Yeah. The legal system would crumble.
Right. Right, exactly. Yeah. And it's like, and if that's true, maybe we should operate as if it were true and let the legal system crumble. I don't know. It's maybe that'll be part two of our conversation.
Above my pay grade. Yeah, that's above my pay grade. Really interesting to consider.
Well, Dr. Harris, this has been very thought-provoking for me, and I appreciate your time and your insight so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. And thank you. Thanks again to everyone who's listening and watching. I trust you've enjoyed the conversation, especially if you're still listening to it. So thank you. And yeah, Dr. Harris, let's stay connected.
Sure.
All right. Take care.